Hello and welcome to A History of Christian Theology. My name's Chad Kim. This week I will be talking with Glenn L. Thompson. Dr. Thompson wrote The Jing Zhao, The Earliest Christian Church in China, with Erdman's Press, and I'm very grateful for Erdman's Press for providing a copy. This conversation with Dr. Thompson talks about a very little known feature of early Christianity, and that is about the Syriac Christian church and how they spread the faith all the way into China. So when I saw this book, I knew that it would be very interesting, given some of the podcasts that we have done on the Chinese house churches with Hannah Nation. But this talks a little bit about the history of Christianity in China, which goes back way further than even I realized, all the way back 13 or 14 centuries, and it's connected to this other lesser known aspect of early Christianity, that is the Syriac-speaking Christians, a language derived from Aramaic and closely associated with Hebrew. And so it's a very interesting story, and Glenn Thompson has the knowledge not only of Syriac, Latin, and Greek, but also learned classical Chinese. So just a great person to think about, to write about this topic, as well as having taught at a university in Asia. But he is now back living in the States. So he's at Asia Lutheran Seminary. Without further ado, this is my conversation with Dr. Glenn Thompson. So do please rate us, review us on iTunes, follow us on Patreon, where we have other episodes and other content as well. Thank you for listening. Here's my conversation with Glenn Thompson. All right. Well, hello and welcome to A History of Christian Theology. My name's Chad Kim. This week I'll be talking with Glenn L. Thompson, primarily about his work in, and actually I probably should even ask you for pronunciation right off the bat, Jing Zhao? How do we say the title of the book?
Jing Zhao.
Jing yes. Zhao, okay. The earliest Christian church in China. And Glenn is retired. We were just talking about that, but I'll let you give a little introduction about your, kind of where you were and where you are now.
Okay. Thank you for having me, Chad. Yes, I was trained as a Lutheran pastor and spent the first 6 years of my ministry in Zambia, working as a missionary and more and more teaching at a seminary. Went back then to do my MA and PhD at Columbia University in New York in Greek and Roman history. My big interest at that time was New Testament textual criticism and the journeys of St. Paul. Somehow, when it came to dissertation phase, I ended up editing the earliest surviving letters of the Bishop of Rome, and that, for some reason, had not been done by Catholic scholars. So that got me into patristics, and for the following quarter century or so, I worked primarily in patristics in my scholarly work. And then starting around the year 2000, began teaching in Hong Kong as part-time visiting professor, and there got interested in early Christianity in China. And now in my most recent years, the last 15 years, I got back to the first century and Paul finally, and I'm also working on a project that is remapping the Roman road system that Paul used in the first century. Retired after serving for 10 years at Asia Lutheran Seminary, a evangelical Lutheran seminary in Hong Kong, and now I'm living in Milwaukee, enjoying my grandkids, and finishing up writing and research projects.
Excellent. Well, you've had quite the journey. It sounds like a number of different languages and other things. So maybe you are the right person to write this book on the Jing Zhao.
Well, that was... yes, as much as I still feel somewhat incompetent in this area, as it was not my area of expertise from my study days, what happened was in 2001, while I was teaching in Hong Kong, a new book had come out by a guy named Martin Palmer about early Christianity in China. And Palmer's book was called The Jesus Sutras, Rediscovering the Lost Scrolls of Taoist Christianity. And when I read that book, it introduced me to the field, but also totally was unconvincing in his interpretation of what this early Christianity was about. And when I looked around for something else to read, what I would think of as a more objective treatment of the subject, I couldn't find anything that had been written in English since 1930, when A.C. Moule had put out a book called Christians in China before the year 1530. So that began a long journey of trying to find what the most recent scholarship was, attending conferences devoted to the subject, and eventually deciding that since nobody else was writing this book, I needed to do it just so my Hong Kong students would have something good to read. And the rest is history, as they say.
That's right. Well, I guess there are so many questions that I want to ask. When I saw the book come across, Erdmans had sent me some stuff, and I saw that this was coming out, and I was fascinated, in part because we talked with Hannah Nation about the house church movement in China, and I realized that I didn't know very much about the history of Christianity in China. So it was very fascinating to me. And the book was just more that, you know, there's just so much stuff that I had no idea about. And I'm supposed to be a scholar of early Christianity, but of course that's usually around the Mediterranean. I had no idea the forays that were made into China from the Syriac church, as it turns out. So I thought maybe we could just start with telling us, so who are the Xing Zhao, and about what time period are we talking about?
Good. And don't feel bad, Chad. I felt exactly the same way as you did back in 2001, having been a church history professor as well, and just coming on this almost out of the blue. As you know, when we study the early church, we're very much influenced by the early church historians, Eusebius and his continuators, Socrates, Sozomen, Theodoret, and the like. But even Eusebius, for the most part, is telling us about what was happening in the Eastern or Greek-speaking part of the church. But we know that there was also a Latin Western half of the Mediterranean. And because our traditions trace back to the Latin church, whether it's through the later Protestant church or not, we're very familiar with those stories about the Greek East and the Latin West. But actually, the real East was east of Palestine, and that story has not been told very often about how Christianity spread in the other direction, and yet it spread almost equally as fast and as widely to the east as it did to the west. It did that predominantly in the Syriac language, a variety of Aramaic, but written in a different font. The Syriac script was used by Christians throughout the East and all the way to China by the 7th century. Better known is that this type of Christianity spread to India sometime in the first three centuries. And so the so-called Thomas Church of India is a little better known to us. But by the time of the rise of Islam in the 7th century, I would think that probably the largest single religion throughout the Middle East was Syriac Christianity, even though it was a minority because there was a number of different religions. It was very well represented throughout Lebanon, Syria, Iraq and what is now Iran, Saudi Arabia, all of that area had a widespread Christian presence, predominantly worshiping in Syriac, the Syriac language. And as we know from later history, what by Marco, well, not until the 19th century did it get the name the Silk Road, but we know this travel that took place between the Roman Empire and China from the later travels of Marco Polo, etc. But that was going on already at the time of Christ, interrupted periodically by wars, etc. But that was the also the highway through which Christianity continued to spread eastward into Central Asia in the 3rd, 4th, 5th, 6th century, and it just worked its way down until it arrived in China formally in the year 635. And that's where the story of the Jing Zhao really begins inside China and extends for about 200 years. In 845, an emperor came along to outlaw the foreign religions. It was really aimed at Buddhism, which had spread very widely and had taken so many people and so much land off the tax rolls that they tried to outlaw Buddhism. But the other so-called foreign religions, which included Christianity, Zoroastrianism, and Manichaeism, all spread from Persia, were also outlawed, and they kind of got caught in the crossfire, if you will. And that seems to have brought to a rather quick end, at least in from our historical knowledge, to that first attempt to Christianize China.
Well, and one thing, just as kind of a quick historical question, I deal a little bit with Manichaeism in North Africa in relationship with Augustine, and sometimes it will be discussed as if they were, you know, a little that it's sometimes harder to tell the differences or something, you know, between sort of Nicene Christianity and Manichaeanism or something. But it seems like the way that the stuff that I was reading in the further east, now, of course, this is a little later than the period that I deal with in the 4th and 5th centuries, but close. It seems like there's very definitive differences among the Zoroastrian, among the Manichees, you know, like the Chinese emperors seem to know, okay, there's one group that is Zoroastrian, there's another group that is Manichaeism, and there's another group that is, I guess, you know, well, in this case, it would, like, a Syriac Christian or Nestorian Christian. Is that correct?
Yes. And we know that because there was actually an imperial decree in China changing the name of the Bose, or Persian church, Christian church, so that it would not be confused with the Manichaeans or the Zoroastrians, which also came from Persia. Now, you did mention the word Nestorian, and since you've read my book, you'll see that one of the things we've been trying to do, those of us who study this area, is try to eliminate that word as much as possible when we're talking about the Syriac Church of the East, and the Church of the East is the preferred name that they themselves use. And but very much that word Nestorian got attached to our earliest knowledge of this church in China, and it has plagued it to some extent to today. And one reason why Chinese Christians have not been very interested in the story of the Jing Zhao is because early on it was labeled Nestorian and therefore dismissed as being just a heretical church, not of any real interest. But nothing that we have found in the documents from this period really suggests that there was any Nestorian Christology attached to the teachings of this church, and therefore we, as Sebastian Brock has written, the great scholar of Syriac Christianity, this is an unfortunate misnomer that has continued and that we're trying to get rid of.
Yeah, it's, I mean, I took one class on Syriac Christianity in my master's program, and I, you know, sort of began to be exposed to a little bit of this tradition. I get, you know, reading your book just reminds me or maybe impressed upon me in a new way just how significant the Syriac language is in the history of Christianity. And, you know, I teach a lot of Latin and Greek. And, you know, to some extent, it feels like Latin is the background of the West. But I had no idea just how significant Syriac as a language is for the development of Christianity and in just an equally large sort of geographic region and certainly a historical region or a time period. I mean,
yes. And the amount of material we have is also astonishing. Again, those of us trained in the Western tradition often weren't aware of this until we really become specialists. But we think of a big bookcase being filled with all the Latin writings and another one with all the Greek writings. Well, you could fill an equally big bookcase with all the original writings that have been preserved, not just translations from the Western Church Fathers, but the original church writings of the Syriac Church. And fortunately, that is now finally getting attention. Unfortunately, I think, because of the tremendous upheavals in the Middle East in the last century, this Church of the East still exists. And Syriac speaking, or at least Syriac worshiping in theory, Christians are still there, though normally Arabic or more modern language is used now liturgically. But that group still exists, but a large percentage have now become emigres due to the fighting in the Middle East, again, where they most of the time just get caught in the crossfire between Sunnis and Shiites and the other warring groups. But as a result, once they emigrate, a lot of these people start clinging to their heritage. And so it's very many of these people have become the new scholars. And when we go to church fathers conferences now, we have large numbers of people who are studying the church fathers, a very positive thing. And we have a lot more to learn about that church.
Yeah. I have so many questions that I want to ask based on even some stuff that we've already been talking about. I guess one of them would be you started off with this text about the sutras of Jesus and the overlap between sort of Taoist ideas and the early Syriac writings and the Syriac mission work in China. And so I do want to get to that. But first, maybe, you know, you spend a lot of time in the book telling us where so we have a trove of documents, and then we have a stele that has a lot of stuff written. So maybe tell us what are the sources that we're looking at when we think about this question of what the Jingzhou taught, and then maybe you could expand a little bit about how that sort of Taoist idea was deployed, but whether or not it's fair to say that it was just sort of Taoist Christianity or whatever that other kind of language is. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, the sources we have, or the texts, are really quite limited. The one that has been longest known, discovered around 1625, was a huge stele, often called the Nestorian stele, or the Jingzhou stele, or the Xi'an stele, because it was found near the ancient capital Chang'an, but the modern city of Xi'an. And this is a huge stele with some 1,800 Chinese characters, but also along the sides, Syriac, a list of Syriac clergy, and some other documentation in Syriac. And for 300 years, that was all we had, basically, besides a few general notices in Chinese sources about this church. And that stele, I give a complete translation, text and translation, in the appendix to my book. But you can find other translations on the internet as well. It ends with a poem, and that recounts it was erected in 781. So it basically tells the story of what happened in the 150 years from the arrival of missionaries in 635 until the stele was erected in 781. And it mentions all the different emperors and how they had favored the church in certain ways. And then it gives some details about other things, including some overview of doctrine and practice in very short order. So that's all we had for quite a while. And then in the early 20th century, in Dun Wang, and now a World Heritage Site out in the middle of the desert, on the edge of the Taklamakan Desert in northwest China, was discovered a side room in a cave that had been sealed around the year 1000 and was chock full of manuscripts, floor to ceiling. 99% of those were Buddhist and other traditional manuscripts, but a few of them were Christian that date to this period. Unfortunately, most of those disappeared shortly after they were discovered and were not rediscovered until about 10 years ago when they popped up in a Japanese collection of Dun Wang manuscripts. So finally, the last 10 years, we again have these documents, are able to look at the texts, make sure we have good transcriptions and good translations, and now we can be pretty sure that they are original documents. Indeed, for a while they were questioned as forgeries, but they now seem to be pretty well admitted as good documents. And there are a variety, a half a dozen different texts, a hymn, a list of sacred books and people that maybe comes from a liturgical context, and then some other tracts that seem try to explain the teachings of this Jingzhou church. But exactly what their purpose was and who they were intended for is still debated somewhat. These are the texts that especially were called sutras by Martin Palmer. Sutra, unfortunately, has the aura of being something that belongs to an Eastern religion rather than Christian religions, and the Chinese characters that are used here just really mean book or sacred text in a more general way. But those documents clearly do have both Confucian, Taoist, and Buddhist terminology mixed in. So Martin Palmer's interpretation was that this was a intentional blending of these religions into a new and better whole by the authors of these texts. Myself, coming from the background of having been a missionary and working in foreign cultures, I saw these totally differently, as attempts to use the terminology that people are familiar with as the starting point, and then explaining the Christian truths from that viewpoint. This, of course, is highly debated, and I've just given away my viewpoint. but at the same time, I have to admit that there is certainly a lot more work to be done in this area. It is certainly possible that one or more of these documents was written by someone who was not familiarly or totally grounded in Christian teaching or totally committed to it, and was, stretching the limits, if you will. One or two of them in particular are a little difficult to get your head around from the viewpoint of traditional Christianity. And these documents are all, by the way, translated in another good book that just beat me to the press. My good friend, Matteo Nicolini-Zani, a Catholic monk from the Bozza Monastery in northern Italy, is a wonderful scholar of the Jingzhou and a good friend who we've gotten to know each other for the last 20 years at conferences. And he just published a book from Oxford University Press last year, or 2022 it came out, The Luminous Way to the East, Texts and History of the First Encounter of Christianity with China. And he gives translations of all the texts. His is a much more technical treatment for scholars than mine. I've tried to make mine a story that the average person interested in church history can follow, whereas he gives a much more detailed examination of these texts and their background. So I would recommend for any listener to go and take a look at his texts and see those. He is working with me and some other people from Hong Kong to start a new website in which we will have all of these materials and translations readily available. But that still is a year or two off, probably. So anyway, this is where we're at with this idea. And there's certainly, it's very clear to anybody who reads this that these texts were produced in a Chinese context. Yeah, but exactly who produced them and for what purpose is still at times up in the air.
Yeah, and just sort of for my listeners, I thought I could read a few of the descriptions that I found particularly thought-provoking and interesting. Let's see, I think this one is from Almsgiving. It's in your book on 119, but it says, it's talking about the Messiah, and it says, therefore, our three-one divided being, the luminous and honorable Messiah, concealing his true majesty, appeared as a human being. And then the next line down, therefore, the Messiah did not remain with God, but he made himself become a man. The Lord himself made him a man, because the power of the Lord is unbounded. It is not like what humans can make. The Lord has a body subject to passions, which he shares with Adam. But anyway, well, actually, even the next line down in that same, I think it's from a different text, Lord Messiah, it talks about the Lord of heaven sent the cool wind to a virgin called Mary. Then the cool wind entered into the tomb of Mary, just as the Lord of heaven had instructed, and Mary became impregnant immediately. And I, you know, just reading those, you could immediately recognize something like the Apostles' Creed or the Nicene Creed. This sounds very, although not the same language in a few points. Obviously, this is in Chinese, so it's going to be slightly different. But the patterns and the basic teachings seem to match on my reading very well with what any sort of Nicene Christian would affirm.
Yes. Absolutely. And as you said, however, it's very clear that it's been put into language that reflects Chinese culture and their way of expressing things. It's so classical Chinese is very poetic. Even the parts that are prose are in a more poetic way of writing. And that comes across very beautifully often in these parts where you talk about, again, from the stele, it's the same story is told. Let me just read what it has there about the incarnation. Therefore, our three-one divided being, and again, three-one is just their way of expressing the Trinity very clearly. But it says, is preceded by the character for our or my. So our 3-1 divided being, making it very clearly where the author is standing. The luminous and honorable Messiah, concealing his true majesty, appeared as a human being. God in heaven proclaimed a celebration. A virgin gave birth to a sage in Da Qin. Da Qin means the Western Empire, far to the west. A luminous star announced the good news. In Persia, they saw it shining and came with tribute. And that, the idea of the star comes up several places because and this is our connection with the Syriac Church again, where the Syriac Church had a special appreciation of the Matthew story of the appearance of the star because they felt that these wise men had come from them, from Persia. And there's stories that they went back and started the first Christian church then in Persia. So they kind of trace their own roots in the Church of the East to that star and so forth.
Yeah. Yeah, and so, you know, so some of this stuff looks very much like, as you say, you said traditional Christianity. I've been sort of saying connecting it to maybe Nicene Christianity. But there's also some other stuff on page one in your book on 117. I think this is from a treatise called Origin. It says, there was no words, no words, no way, no original cause, only the mysterious existence that was non-existent. And you say that this is talking about the creator and the creation. So in this line, you say, you know, you see the word no way, no Tao.
Yes, and the classical Taoist and Buddhist expressions like Wu Wei and so forth do appear frequently. Especially in the Origins is one of those documents that is, as I said, is the most difficult for us to parse from a Nicene point of view or try to get a handle on. And that this one is particularly interesting because that text actually is the one that we have that appears twice. Besides being in one of this Don't Do Wong documents, it also appears on a pillar that was discovered about 15 years ago in the eastern capital of Luoyang. And since it was on a pillar, memorial pillar, as well as in a text, we know that it wasn't just some one-off experiment, but it seemed to have had some more official standing. And the fact that it appears on a pillar that was used normally for Buddhist texts, but this one has a cross and angels on the top and a Christian text, shows us that, yeah, maybe at times, you know, the division, at least for everybody involved, was not exactly clear all the time.
Yeah. Well, and even that, as you say, is pretty interesting, like how definitive it is as relating again to the Jesus tradition, having crosses. And you later tell the story, I think it's Marco Polo who comes and who sees the crosses, but they don't have Jesus on them. They're not crucifixes. But even that very clearly stamps them as different within the sort of the traditional religions of China or with other religions that are in China.
Right. Yeah. I recently wrote an article critiquing a professor, an American professor who had written an article trying to claim that the cross was being minimized because it wasn't mentioned very much on the big stele. And I argued very strongly the opposite, that yes, the stele text on its own is very problematic because it was put up on this huge stone, obviously, for public display. And therefore, its text would have had to have been vetted by the imperial government. But the text was written in a way that would express the teachings of the church in a positive way to passers-by without, you know, denigrating the opposition, if you will, and other religions, and certainly having to say only good things about emperors. All of that made it a complicated text to write, when at the same time they wanted to express, you know, accurately the Christian teaching, and Christians reading this text would not have been offended either. So that makes this text different, and we should not take this as the the best text perhaps to be used for catechetical instruction or something. And it's quite interesting because the same accusation, of course, comes in the 16th, 17th century against the Jesuits when they first came into China and started having some success. When the Augustinians and Franciscans and Dominicans got in, they started immediately accusing the Jesuits of not teaching the crucifixion and the cross. And the reason was because they did not highlight the cross, you know, publicly as much as the other orders did. But this was partly because they understood Chinese culture so well, and the cross as such has no meaning to the average Chinese person. Crucifixion was not practiced among the Chinese. The cross is a Chinese character that means 10, the normal one for 10, but can also then be used of the four corners of the world or something like that at times as well. But its normal meaning is just 10. It's the character for 10. So talking about crucifixion or being put up on a cross, using this is just not something that's going to hit home unless you have time to explain it. So to me, it, when you read these other texts, the almsgiving or the Messiah texts that you quoted earlier, go into great detail talking about the arrest of Jesus and his crucifixion and so forth. They're not avoiding that whatsoever. So the reason that it isn't up on the stele so much is for a totally different reason.
Yeah. Well, so just for want of time, there's lots of interesting stuff to mine about the theology of how all this works. But just to, you know, keep us moving, I was one of the things that I sort of asked you about was like contemporary Chinese people who are also Christians don't seem to draw on this heritage as strongly. You mentioned the Martoma Christians in India, and there's a very clear like desire to see the continuity in Christianity in India over 2,000 years or 1,800 or however long. So what's different in China if there is very clearly some, you know, continuous presence, or maybe not continuous presence in China, but there's some kind of somewhat regular appearance of Christianity in China? Why is there not a connection to that history?
Yeah, when I teach the history of Christianity in China, I talk about five waves of Christian presence. And the reality is there has not been one continuous chain over the years. Mm. So this first wave of the Jingzhao was from 635 to the middle of the 9th century. Almost at the same time as the Jingzhao was outlawed in China, new converts, however, were springing up in northwest China among the Turkic tribes and the steppes up there. And this seeped into China very strongly under the Mongol rule. And so the last chapter of my book talks about this second flowering of Syriac Christianity during the Song and Yuan dynasties, from approximately 1000 to 1400. But then again, when the Yuan dynasty fell, Christianity seems to have disappeared until the Jesuits come back around 1600 under Matteo Ricci and others. And again, it started flourishing. They looked around to find the remnants of the earlier church, which they knew about from Marco Polo and other travelers, and they couldn't find any. But they were excited when they heard about the stele, and they went and they were the ones who translated and spread it to the West very quickly. But they survived for about 200 years, but then because of the disagreements between the orders, the Jesuits ended up being outlawed both in Europe for a while, disbanded, and then also shortly after that, outlawed from China. So again, we have a small window of no physical presence that we know of between 1725 and about the middle of the 19th century. So in the 19th century, the missions, the great mission century, both Catholics and Protestant missions come back. They can't really get into the country till about 1850, when the Opium Wars kind of force China open. And then we have about one century of great mission presence down until 1950. And that is the time when most current Chinese Christians will trace any roots to, if you will. But then in 1950, with the rise of the Chinese Communist Party, foreign Christians and missionaries were forced out of the country again. And so the last 75 years has been a wonderful period of indigenous Christianity. But whether you're in Hong Kong or Taiwan or mainland China, most of the time they'll look to their roots in this last 150 years. And partly they don't connect with the Jingzhou or have not in the past because, as we mentioned earlier, the name Nestorian was attached to them. But since we've started succeeding in getting rid of that term and starting to tell this story, actually, there's been a wonderful uptick in interest among Christians. And when I've gone to visit the few Jingzhou sites that are to be visited in China, almost always I will find Christians from Hong Kong or Taiwan also visiting those sites, because there is now quite a strong interest in this. There have been some efforts to try to use the Jingzhou as a kind of a ecumenical connection point to unify or get some sort of commonality among modern Chinese Christians. But that has not really succeeded very much, for at least for those people who get serious about looking at the Jingzhou. Among Protestants, modern Protestant Christians, and there may be as many as 100 million of those in China and Hong Kong and Taiwan, the overarching ethos, doctrinal ethos, is kind of a Arminian presence with a healthy dose or unhealthy dose, depending on what you think of Pentecostalism. There's been a resurgence of Reformed theology in certain areas. But those are the biggest trends that have influenced Chinese Christianity, especially in the 20th century and early 21st century. And when you look back at the Jingzhou, what do you find? You see a very strong sacramental and liturgical church body. And those are not, you know, the strong points, if you will, of the modern Chinese church. I think I try to argue that maybe this is something that the modern church can learn from the ancient church, a healthy addition. But that has kind of prevented those who have really studied in detail to make a facile, you know, comparison or adaptation of this. There is a whole cadre of young scholars, Chinese scholars, both Christian and non-Christian, who are studying the Jingzhou. I know of three or four doctoral dissertations that have been written in the last two or three years by young Chinese scholars on aspects of the Jingzhou. So there is a lot of interest there. But really, I think we could have to say there's really no firm connection that we can make historically, or that the current Chinese house churches and even the current Catholic Church, whether the one above ground or underground, would make with the Jingzhou.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting you mentioned the sacramental part of the kind of early Syriac versions of Christianity. I think you mentioned this in there. Just a curious question. And did they primarily worship in Syriac then in the period of the Jingzhou? Do we know exactly what that looked like? Or
no, this is one of the difficult areas. Syriac continued to be an important language for the Church of the East, wherever it spread. But it's very difficult for us to know what was really happening in the daily and weekly services of the church. One of the documents we do have is a version of the Gloria in Excelsis Deo that was translated into Chinese, and we have the Chinese version of it. We also know that that was translated into Sogdian. Sogdian is, we haven't mentioned, but the Sogdian culture was the kind of the lingua franca between the Middle East and Persia and China. So Sogdians are the name we give to the people who were the middlemen traders along the Silk Road. And their Sogdian language, like most of the Central Asian languages of this period, was written in Syriac-style script. The Syriac people, again, were the first ones to come through with a written language and helped put the other languages into writing. We do have excavations from a monastery at a place called Turfan, on a oasis in the northwest area, and more excavations are being done right now, but a treasure trove of documents was found in the early 20th century at a what must have been a monastery complex, and we find writings, Christian writings, in about 15 or 20 different Central Asian languages and scripts, and often a very big mix of scripts, so that something will be written in Syriac, but the text is actually Old Turkic, or the text is Sogdian, but it's being written in Old Turkic script. So a very big multicultural mix that was going on. When we come to the Jingzhou in China itself, on the stele we have the names of about 60 or 70 different clergy. Their names are given in Syriac and Chinese for the most part, both languages often. Were these traditional Chinese people who took a Christian name when they were baptized, or were they Chinese or Syriac people who took a local Chinese name when they started working there? Very difficult to know. We know that some of this Christians we know by name from inscriptions have more Sogdian and Central Asian names. So I think the majority of scholars feel that the Jingzhou remained, to a large extent, a immigrant church. I argued in one of my earliest papers that the Jingzhou was accepted in 635 because they had been requested to come by Syriac Christians who had settled in China, the tradesmen, and they asked that a bishop be sent to baptize their children and everything. But then they obviously did also want to reach out to local people. But exactly how successful they were at that and what percentage of the Jingzhou church ever became Han Chinese, the local more indigenous Chinese population, is something that scholars still argue about. Most probably feel that it remained with a very strong foreign flavor to it, remained more of a foreign religion that attracted local adherents to some extent.
And one thing that I may have missed in a too quick of a read, did we find any translations of the scriptures in the documents and stuff that you've looked at?
We have some translations from Turfan of little liturgical sections and scriptural sections, but no, that's a very good question. There we have the titles of what appear to be translations of parts of scripture, but we really don't. None of the documents that we have in extension are parts of scripture. Let me, if I could, just switch. There's one story I would like to tell that I think is important from the second flowering, the so-called Yellowcoen period, under from 900 or 1000 to 1400. And I should just say that that word Yellowcoen, we have no idea what that means. And why the name changed from one to another has not been understood. But there are plenty of Chinese, local Chinese documents that talk about the Yellowcoen population and overseeing them. But we have this wonderful story how about two monks living not too far from modern Beijing. One was named Mark and the other Barsauma. And they were... probably Angut Christians. The Angut was one of the Turkic tribes that converted partially to Christianity and then was absorbed into the Mongol Empire. And that's probably their ethnic background. But they're part of this Church of the East up near Beijing. And about 1281 or about 1279, they decide they want to go back to the Middle East to visit the headquarters of Mother Church and to see the sacred sites in Palestine. And we have a detailed diary of their travels back. And it took them about 2 years. They get back to Seleucia Ctesiphon near modern Baghdad, where the Patriarch of the Church of the East was located. And they're welcome. They're carrying letters from the church officials in China and from the local Khan. And they're welcomed, and then they go off to Palestine, but can't get there because of battles going on and fighting during this time of the late time of the Crusades. So they go back to Babylon, to Seleucia Ctesiphon, and the patriarch of the Church of the East dies at that point. Mark, one of these two, had been appointed to be the new archbishop for China. And so he takes part in the election process for the new Patriarch of the East. And lo and behold, he himself is elected to be the new Patriarch of the Church of the East in 1281. And he becomes known as Yabalaha III. And he is Patriarch from 1281 to 1317.
Wow.
Meanwhile, his sidekick, Barsauma, he keeps him around and he sends him off to Europe to be his emissary to announce the new patriarch's presence and to try to broker some negotiations. And he meets the patriarch in Constantinople, a pope in Rome, Philip the Fair, the king of France, and Edward the First of England. And we can just imagine here in 1287, 1288, this monk having come all the way from China, sitting and trying to explain about the Chinese church to the King of France in England. And then he goes back and they both end up dying, and then their diary gets published. And recently you can get a wonderful translation by another great scholar and friend of mine, Pier Giorgio Borbone, just published a new translation of this diary in 2021, and it's available very cheaply on by ebook. But this story really shows that when we talk about the Church of the East possibly becoming somewhat Taoist or whatnot, the connection with the Mother Church was always there, and they were constantly getting new people coming from the Middle East. And we just know enough about the Church of the East to know that, you know, if somebody went off the rails doctrinally, this would be noticed. And you don't take somebody from Beijing and make them your new patriarch if you're at all suspect that they might be, you know, half Chinese in their religion and not thoroughly Orthodox.
Right.
So I think this story is just one that we happen to know of because of historical happenstance that kind of confirms that this connection was there and this church was an Orthodox Christian church.
Yeah. Yeah, that for some reason it just reminds me. I heard a lecture at SLU recently from a friend of mine, Vince Bantu, who does a lot of work on Christianity in Africa after after Augustine, after the 5th and 6th century, and tries to sort of show some more indigenous forms of Christianity in Africa before Westerners, the much later missionary movements. And he was just reciting some of the awareness that the popes had in the 11th and 12th century of bishops in Carthage, in a time when you don't normally think of there being Christians in Africa, there very clearly were.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's what, again, Marco Polo found when he went through China too. You know, he found groups of Christians everywhere. Most of them were, what he would have called Nestorian Christians, the Church of the East, but he also found congregations of Armenian Christians, for instance, along the way. So, we know so little that, you know, it's very, one has to be very cautious about making arguments from silence about what did or didn't occur there.
So two questions, both kind of quick. First one, so when I was reading reading through your book, I realized, so you have to work in what, 6-7 languages to go through this book? Chinese, Syriac, and then I know, Greek, Latin, Hebrew. I mean, this is a monument of scholarship, just acquiring all the languages to be able to tell this story.
Yes, and I do very much feel inadequate. My Syriac and my classical Chinese both are very deficient in many ways. But again, the only reason I felt confident putting this into print is because I had surrounded myself with so many competent scholars. The University of Salzburg has had conferences every 3 or 4 years for the last 25 years on this subject, and that's where I got to know people like Professor Borbone and Nicolini Zani and the others, the real experts. But I was the one who am more the general historian, and what I did was take their research and put it together. I've read through all the texts together with local Chinese scholars of the Tang Dynasty period, etc., so that I got familiar with the material. But it takes a lot. And again, most of the modern publications, or many of the modern publications, again, are in Italian, French, and German as well. There didn't seem to be a lot of English-speaking scholars doing this work. Hmm. And that's, again, one of the reasons I thought I would jump into the gap and do the best I could.
Well, I thought maybe I would just ask you if you would like, and if you don't want to, please, you can decline and we can end the podcast before this. But I just wonder, as a Christian person, as a missionary, as someone of faith, how does this strike you as a Christian when you hear this story and about the spread of the gospel through all of these countries? I don't know. How do you understand that as a man of faith?
Well, Scripture tells us that the word never returns void. And I think this is just another example of that. And if we have this story that, hung on the discovery of one stone 400 years ago, just think of all the other stories out there where that one stone hasn't been discovered or come along. So it's wonderfully humbling, but also encouraging to know that the Lord is working in these ways in languages that, we haven't even heard of previously, Old Turkic and Sogdian and some of these. And that, despite all of our frailties and, issues that the church has had, that somehow the teaching still goes out, and it has gone out. For my Chinese students, I thought it was very important for them to realize that, you know, that this gospel has been preached in their country. Their great, 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 great grandparents may have heard the gospel way back in the Tang Dynasty time. And despite all of the efforts to stamp it out and to prohibit it and all the other things, it keeps coming back again and again. And everything I've had in the last 20 years as far as my connection with Chinese Christians has done nothing but encourage me and make me very much positive about the future of Christianity in China. We have just fabulously committed Christians there who continue to, under very difficult circumstances sometimes, confess their faith. And that's the faith that the Jingzhao had, that we had already at Nicaea, and which we all continue to share.
Well, my guest today has been Glenn Thompson, and I appreciate you sharing a little bit of your scholarship as well as some reflections on what that has meant for you and your students in China. So thank you, Glenn.
My pleasure.